And now with all that, please join me in welcoming Lori Unum, Vice President of Autism Speaks. Thanks for taking three flights.
Yes.
A little delayed yesterday to make it here last night.
My pleasure.
Really nice dinner last night, conversation, and looking forward to this morning. So, thank you for making this time. It's actually...
Thank you for the invitation. I was... you're going to tell the story of how we met. I don't know.
Go for it.
Well, we met on an airplane. Matt and I were both flying to Indianapolis last year and ended up seated next to each other and just got chatting. What do you do? That sort of thing. And I was so enamored with the thought of Morning Philip and what a great idea it is. So I just love that there are all these people who are willing to get up in the very cold weather and be here at 7 a.m. just to learn more about a topic of interest and to collaborate and to be a community. So kudos to you on organizing this, and thank you for the invitation to be a part.
It was that short conversation, and you shared what you do and why that was important to you and how you started doing what you've done over the last 14 or so years. Mm-hmm. And I hope today we get to talk about that story and a lot more about autism. Can we start there? Can we start at how you learned about autism and why that's important to you?
Sure. So that's a long story, so I hope I don't take the whole hour just telling this story. But my husband and I were living in Washington, D.C. Neither of us is from D.C. He's from Boston. I'm from South Carolina, which you can probably tell. And when our firstborn child was not making the kind of progress that he should have been making, it was at his 18-month-old checkup when he had never spoken a word and wasn't reaching milestones, that the pediatrician said to us, "I want to refer you for an evaluation." I didn't really know that much about how a typical child should develop because it was my first child. But we followed up on the evaluations. It took months to get in with a specialist who could give him a thorough examination. And so shortly before his second birthday, he had been diagnosed with classic autism. He actually got three different diagnoses because I had been on the waiting list trying to get an appointment, and I just followed up on each appointment. So looking back, that was kind of fortunate. He was diagnosed at Johns Hopkins. He was diagnosed at Georgetown. He was diagnosed at Children's National Medical Center. I think maybe I was hoping if I kept going, it would be something different. It wouldn't be autism, but it was every time. It was autism, and he was pretty severely impaired with autism. And all three of the doctors at those very fine medical institutions said to us, if you want your child to have any shot at a functional life, you need to get him right away into this very intensive behavior therapy called Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA. I barely knew what autism was. I certainly didn't know what Applied Behavior Analysis was. My whole world just started spinning right then. But I cried and I picked myself back up and said, okay, we're going to do what the doctors told us to do. We're going to figure out what is applied behavior analysis, how do we even get it. Because we were living in Washington, D.C., we were lucky that we could find some providers who were in business right there in our town. And so we brought them into our home and they explained what applied behavior analysis is. And it's this one-on-one therapy or intervention where a consultant, a trained behavior analyst, develops an individualized program for a child with autism to address whatever his or her particular deficits are. So for example, my child didn't know how to speak, didn't know how to imitate, and many other skills that a two-year-old should have had. So a behavior analyst would design a therapy program to elicit speech, to elicit imitation skills. It's very scientific, and I'm not going to try to explain exactly how it all works, but it's part of the story that we had been told to put our child into this therapy for 40 hours a week, which again made me cry. And I thought, what do you mean? 40 hours a week, that's a full-time job. He's two. He can't do this for 40 hours a week. And they said, yes, he can. And he will not develop if you do not put him in this kind of intensive intervention. So again, you know, we just accepted, okay, our lives have changed completely, and we're going to do what the doctors told us to do. So the therapist came to our home, and they explained how they would work in our home so that we didn't have to take him somewhere constantly. And I said, well, gosh, what does that cost? If you've got the supervisor designing the program, and then you've got this team of technicians who come to your house in three-hour sessions to work with the child, that must be expensive. And they did the math and said it would run about $70,000 a year. And I remember turning to my husband and saying, oh my gosh, thank goodness we have health insurance. Who laughed? Yes, I didn't know. At that time, I had no idea health insurance would not pay one penny of it. And I thought, what? I mean, my child was just diagnosed with a condition by a doctor, and the doctor said this is what he needs to make improvements. I thought that's what health insurance is for. I thought that's why I've been paying premiums my whole working life, is in case something like this happens to my family. But they wouldn't pay a penny. And I couldn't understand why, but at that moment, my thought was not, I'm going to challenge the insurance industry. My thought was, how are we going to get this for our son? I mean, we turned all of our attention to, we have to do this. We don't happen to have an extra $70,000 sitting around, but we have to do this. Luckily, I mean, my husband and I are both lawyers. We didn't have big paying lawyer jobs, but we had jobs, and we were able to make sacrifices. Basically, we lived on my husband's salary, and we used my entire salary to pay for the therapy for our son, Ryan. And we were grateful to be able to do that. You know, and we did that for a few years, and at one point we sold our house and we moved to a less expensive house so that we could continue the therapy that was helping him. But a few years into it, we moved to South Carolina, by the way, a few years into his diagnosis, because we had gotten to the point where we really just needed support from our family. Being alone in Washington, D.C., with no one to help, like, we couldn't go to the grocery store with him. He was way too disruptive, just bad behaviors and screaming. We couldn't go to a restaurant. We stopped going to church. We tried going to church, and he would scream. And so it just wasn't good, and we decided we'll move back to my home state to be nearer family so that somebody can provide that support. So at this point, as we were situating back in South Carolina, I really started thinking, you know, we're making it work, but we're making it work because we're this two-income family that can sell a house and can use one whole salary. What does your average family do? What does your average family do? I remember looking up what is the average household income in South Carolina, and it was around $40,000. And I thought, well, so if an average family has a child get diagnosed with autism, you know, they haven't planned for this. It's not something you expect. How are those children getting treatment? And of course, the answer is they weren't. They weren't. At that point, the state of affairs essentially was, if the child was lucky enough to be born into a family that was independently wealthy or could make sacrifices, they would get the treatment. And if they weren't, they just didn't get it. And I could not sleep at night just thinking about, that is so unfair. That is so unfair. And so I sat down at my kitchen table I had this moment really of, you know, what can we do about this? And I had this moment of, you know what? I think there's a reason that God gave me this child, and I have a law degree, and I'm a pretty good writer. I think I'm supposed to do something about this. And I sat down at my kitchen table and wrote out just what I thought the law should be as a piece of legislation. I had never written a bill or anything like that before. And I went to a legislator in South Carolina and asked him if he would file that bill. And the piece of legislation was very simple. It was two paragraphs. It really just said, if you're an insurance company doing business in this state and one of your members is diagnosed with autism, you have to pay for the treatment that is recommended by the physician. You know, evidence-based, mainstream treatment, you should be paying for that. It seemed like a very simple idea, like such common sense to me. That was 2005. It wasn't so simple. It was a two-year process to get that going in the legislature, and the insurance companies came out swinging. They were vehemently opposed to my little common sense bill, and they fought it with all their might and their powerful lobbyists and their money and everything else. So it was a very, very difficult journey. I recruited every autism family I could find in South Carolina to help, and we went to all the legislators and just sat down with each one of them and said, let me tell you about autism. There wasn't nearly as much awareness about autism 15 years ago as there is now. So we educated each one and said, let us just, you know, tell you what autism is, how it affects the family, and how hard it is if insurance isn't playing its part. So very long story, somewhat short, I guess. After 2 years, that bill passed the South Carolina legislature and became known as Ryan's Law after my son. So that is a long answer to your short question of how did you get into this.
Thanks. Before we go on, your son Ryan is going to be 18 this year.
In a few weeks.
Will you talk a little bit about Ryan today?
So Ryan, we were talking at dinner last night about how this behavior therapy works and is it always successful. Ryan is not one of the best outcome kids. Like some of the kids that get this ABA therapy will be in therapy for a few years and they do so well, they really go back into public school indistinguishable from their peers. They can go into first grade, be in a typical classroom. That wasn't Ryan's experience, unfortunately. But do I believe the therapy was successful for him? I do. Because even though he's about to turn 18 and he's still essentially nonverbal, he can say some words, but he can't have a conversation. He has made such enormous progress through this intervention that now we do go to restaurants with him. He goes to church with us. Now, instead of taking him grocery shopping, I give him my grocery list and say, go get all this. And he can read the list and find everything, and he just learned how to use a debit card. So it has brought him to a point where I believe he is employable. Whereas a typical, you know, a child at his level of functioning in the old days would have gone right into a residential, an institutional setting. That's not the future that I see for Ryan. Kelly is smiling back there because she does this work supporting individuals looking for employment. Black Hills Works, is that the name? Yes. And so that's where I see his future. So I think it was successful, and we're very happy to have been able to make that investment in his future.
Thanks for sharing, and thanks for that introduction. Ryan's Law, in some fashion, is in how many states today?
So the next little piece, I'll tell the story instead of just answering the question. The next little piece of the story is that after Ryan's Law passed in South Carolina, I was done. You know, I had written the bill, gotten it passed. I went back to my job. I did not work for Autism Speaks at that time. I was doing that just as a mom. I just thought, you know, this is the right thing to do. But Autism Speaks is a national nonprofit, based in New York that had recently been founded. And Autism Speaks contacted me the next year after Ryan's law passed in 2007 and said, you know what, we think that's a really neat law that you all passed down there in South Carolina. Why don't you come work for us and try to replicate that law in all 50 states? And it took me a while to decide whether I was going to quit my job and go work for Autism Speaks, but I did. In 2008, I left my legal career, went to work for Autism Speaks with the mission of go around the country and see if we can pass that law in other states. And last year, we hit our 48th state.
Something you've shared in the last 24 hours, Lori, was that right before the law passed in South Carolina, the night before, like 10:30 at night, the governor vetoed it.
Yes.
And you phoned, will you talk about that next 24 hours?
I will. So when, as I said, it was a two-year process to get this law passed in South Carolina, with hundreds of autism families and friends, you know, grandmas, grandpas, teachers, everybody wanted this to pass so badly. We worked so hard. It finally passed in May of 2007, and we celebrated, but it hadn't been signed by the governor yet. And on the night before the session ended, the governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, vetoed the bill. Some of you remember Mark Sanford. Yes, okay. He ultimately got what was coming to him. oh, we're recording, aren't we? I shouldn't have said that. I was so mad. Like literally at 10:30 at night, he vetoed the bill. And a legislator called me to tell me that it had been vetoed. And I thought, you have got to be kidding me. So I stayed up that night calling all these autism families and waking them up to tell them, you got to get back to the state house tomorrow morning because there's one day left in the session. There is a day left. Let's show up en masse and see if we can get that veto overridden. And that's exactly what we did. There were about 75 people there the next morning. And the people were like, I don't have time to get a babysitter. I said, don't worry about it. Just bring them. Just get there. That'll be even better. You know, let's have a few screaming kids there. And so that next day, if you know anything about the legislative process, even getting on the agenda is kind of on the last day of session, you know, there's so many people that want their bill to be taken care of, so it was very difficult to even get them to take it up. But they did. Both the House and the Senate took it up and voted unanimously to override the governor's veto. So it was an amazing ending to a long journey. And I didn't tell you this part last night, but Governor Sanford called me a few days later. I didn't know him. We had not talked about it, and that was my bad that I didn't know I needed to talk to him about it. But he called me a few days later to explain his reasoning, and I said, you know what? I'm at Disney World with my kids right now. No thanks. you know, at that point, it had already been done, and whatever the reasoning was, it didn't really matter at that point. And I really was at Disney World with my kids, so we didn't share.
You were in Washington, D.C. before you moved back to South Carolina 16 years ago.
Yes.
If you didn't dedicate yourself to this, what would you be doing professionally?
I'm not sure, but I, at the time Ryan was diagnosed, so I originally moved to Washington, D.C. to work for the United States Department of Justice. I was a trial attorney in the civil division of the Department of Justice, which I really enjoyed. I did that for 6 years, and then I went into teaching. And so I was teaching law school at George Washington University. It was during that period that my son was diagnosed while I was teaching. I really, really enjoyed that, and probably would have held on to a teaching career I think, for the rest of my career. I will also share that I have always had an interest in politics. My father was a state legislator, and I didn't share this with you yet either, but my sister also was elected to the state legislature, and in fact was the youngest legislator in America when she was elected. This was many years ago. If this tells you anything, when she got elected as the youngest legislator in America, she got interviewed on the Today Show by Barbara Walters. So this was a while back. The young people in here are like, who's that? I don't even know who that is. So I think, you know, possibly a political career might have been in the works. But, you know, I feel like I am still in a political career, just from a different angle.
Would you ever run for office?
I wouldn't say no to that. I don't foresee it at this point because life is still complicated. But, you know, it might be a good thing to have some more people in office who have complicated lives. You know, would understand things at a little deeper level.
There's no cure for autism. What makes early diagnosis and treatment provided with Ryan's law so important?
Well, children with autism can make enormous progress, but it's so important to start as early as you can. You know, we were so lucky to have a diagnosis before he was even 2, but the average age of diagnosis is over 4, and you've missed some really critical intervention years at that point. That doesn't mean that you don't start. I've seen children start into ABA therapy at 5, 6, and 7 and make enormous progress. But the brain is so malleable when children are toddlers. You can just really get in there and almost change the wiring. I'm not a scientist, so I don't want to explain neurologically exactly what's happening, but it's just astonishing. Nonverbal children can gain verbal skills. They can become talkers and maintain that. Children who have social deficits can gain the understanding of social communication. So you can really change the entire trajectory of a child's life if you can get in there early.
A series of questions I'm going to just roll out and we can just go through them.
Okay.
How many people are estimated to have autism in the United States?
So I don't know that I can give you a figure of how many people have autism. What I can tell you is that the prevalence rate, the rate at which people are being diagnosed currently, continues to escalate. 20 years ago, it was about 1 in 2,500. Today, it's 1 in 59. 1 in 59 children is diagnosed on the spectrum. Now, you kind of said, wow, and I did too when I heard that figure. It's astonishing to me. But one thing that's really important to keep in mind is the very wide spectrum. It's called autism spectrum disorder for a reason. And I can tell you there aren't 1 in 59 people like my son Ryan, who's very severely impaired. There are a lot of people at the other end of the spectrum who you might not even know they have autism. They kind of function okay in society. Maybe they're a little quirky. They have a hard time reading social cues. So I think some of the escalating prevalence is there was a slight broadening of the diagnostic criteria some years back that created Asperger's syndrome. And so a lot more people are wrapped into that.
Can we actually take another step in that conversation? Mm-hmm. So when you think of people in society today that are well known, or historical figures. Can we talk about a few examples
of
people that would be identified on the spectrum?
Yeah, well, so I of course don't know Bill Gates's medical history, but there is a lot of speculation that Bill Gates is on the spectrum. People
now,
say
now
Einstein.
Why Bill Gates or Einstein?
Yeah, well, so I'm gonna bring this personal again just for a moment. I shared last night, I have 3 sons, and my youngest son is actually diagnosed on the spectrum as well. I don't talk about him as much. He's 11 years old, and he is the polar opposite end of the spectrum from Ryan. So Ryan is nonverbal, some aggressive behaviors, some self-injurious behaviors. Sometimes people with autism will injure themselves. Jonathan, my youngest, is so smart I can barely talk to him. He has difficulty fitting in socially. And so he, much perhaps like Bill Gates, he talks about, at the dinner table, he talks a lot about quantum physics, which I don't really even know what that is. I do a lot of nodding my head. He believes he is going to cure cancer, and he talks a lot about his theories. And I just think, I bet that's what Bill Gates talked about at the dinner table at home. I bet he talked about, you know, creating computers and making better programs. And, you know, so I love that autism can be an asset. And my youngest son, I mean, for my oldest son, it's debilitating. Give me a choice, would I have him have autism or not? Absolutely not. I would not have him have autism because it's a difficult road for him. But my youngest son, he considers it an asset, and I wouldn't change him. I would not take it away from him because I think he's going to make great contributions to society, and he loves looking at people like Bill Gates and Albert Einstein and thinking, oh, I'm right there in their path. I love it.
You mentioned on average, I think it was, autism is diagnosed at age 4. Mm-hmm. How is autism diagnosed?
I got to sneeze.
We're all just watching you.
I know. Thank you for that.
No problem.
It went away. It went away. I think we'd make a good talk show. Yeah.
I'm no Barbara Walters.
Autism is diagnosed by a specialist. Usually a pediatrician is the first one who flags it. And a pediatrician should perform a screen for autism, but typically is not the one that diagnoses for autism. There's a screening tool called the MCHAT, modified checklist for autism in toddlers. And so that's what a pediatrician should do. And it's like a 20-question survey. Any pediatricians here? You can fill me in if I don't have all the right details. But then the pediatrician, if there's a positive score on the MCHAT, the pediatrician will refer to either a developmental pediatrician, someone who has extra training in human development, or a psychologist, or sometimes a neurologist, who are trained to perform, typically it's an instrument called the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale. And it's a very comprehensive test that looks at verbal communication, verbal and nonverbal communication skills. Are there deficits in communication? It looks at behavioral abnormalities, social interactions. Sadly, there's no test. There's no blood test or anything definitive like that. So it really depends very much on the medical professional's expertise in, comparing a child's manifestations to a typical child and determining how far off are we. And basically you look at, autism is a condition in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And if you meet a certain amount of criteria in this DSM definition, that's when you get a definition, a diagnosis of autism.
Why is there a difference in age for autism to be diagnosed in poorer populations?
Access to care. It's still an issue for people in poorer populations. Sometimes in rural communities, you might not have as many pediatricians who are trained to screen. And then even if they are, they don't have the experts, the diagnosticians to refer to sometimes. There's a lack of adequate coverage even for the diagnostic workups at times. And frankly, I've talked about all of my work and Autism Speaks work getting health insurance to pay for this. There's a whole nother strain of our work that I haven't mentioned yet, and that was to get Medicaid to pay for the diagnosis and the treatment of autism. And we finally have succeeded in most of the country on that, but it wasn't until 2014 that we got CMS, the Federal Medicaid Agency, to issue a bulletin to all the states saying, hey, you gotta be covering this autism, right? A lot of states weren't covering it through Medicaid, so your poorer populations maybe would have suspicions, but they wouldn't have the access to the care.
What do you suppose is the most misunderstood about autism today?
There's a saying in the autism world, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism, or one person with autism, you've met one person. And I don't know if that makes a lot of sense outside of the autism context, but what that really means is, even though there are common deficits around communication and behavior, every individual with autism presents himself or herself potentially very differently from the next one. And so it's frustrating, I think, for people with autism, for families with autism, to meet people who say, oh, you know, my next door neighbor's nephew has autism. I know what you're dealing with. Well, you don't. You have no idea. Well, first of all, you're not living with it if it's your next door neighbor's nephew, right? And secondly, your next door neighbor's nephew might be like the good doctor on TV, not someone who's banging his head on the wall and can't speak and isn't potty trained. So I think it's really important, for speaking for the autism community, that people acknowledge, even if you've got some familiarity with autism, please realize you may not know the spectrum and you may not really have any sense of what an autism family is living with and dealing with.
Laura, you've shared stories about Ryan, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if you would share a few of the most important things you've learned from your autistic son.
Patience. I would say I've learned to appreciate small victories. We've learned to slow down, and we've learned to realize, well, this is not a small victory, so it's not a good example, but I remember when his ABA therapist asked us, when he was 6 or 7 years old, did we want Ryan to learn how to ride a bike? I said, yeah, of course we do, and we want him to fly to the moon as well. You know, he doesn't have language. He doesn't understand the word pedal. He doesn't understand steering. I thought that was crazy that this child would ever learn to ride a bike. And one of his therapists decided he was going to show me, and he introduced Ryan to a bicycle and pretty much ran behind the bicycle holding it for about 2 years. I kid you not, every night they would be outside. This therapist, who was in great shape, and really great shape at the end of the 2 years, you know, was holding the back of Ryan's bicycle, teaching him to pedal, teaching him to hold the handlebars. And, ooh, I'm about to choke up now, but the day that I went outside with Ryan and we rode bikes together side by side, I'll never forget it. And there's a picture on our wall of that night. You know, some people have these formal pictures of their kids in the living room. We have a picture of Ryan on the bike that night, and that's a victory that our family celebrates.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about autism in children. And Ryan's turning 18.
Yes.
Can we talk about autism in adults?
No.
Okay.
So I'm pretty terrified of Ryan turning 18 on March 16th. And that's awful that here I am, someone who works in autism full time, and I'm terrified. So there's a lot, we're in the process of seeking guardianship of Ryan. So, you know, if your child doesn't achieve a level of independent functioning, which he's certainly not at independence, then you've got to make that legal decision at the 18th birthday. What's going to be his legal capacity moving forward? That can be a very emotional time for a lot of families, especially if the child's kind of on the cusp. In some ways, we're lucky because Ryan's really not on the cusp of being able to live independently. So we know we have to obtain guardianship. And then we have to think about what is he going to do with his days and where is he going to live? And he lives at home with us and, of course, is welcome to live at home with us. But we are going to die at some point, probably before Ryan dies. And we spend a little bit of time every day, I would say, thinking about that. Where is Ryan going to be when we pass away? Who's going to take care of him the way we would take care of him? And so you know, I really think two buckets. How is he going to spend his days? Where is he going to live? And who's going to take care of him? I already mentioned that we believe that he is employable. And so how he's going to spend his days is we're going to find him a job. We've got to find an employer who's very open-minded and willing to think outside the box. But I shared last night that we recently were testing him on some different job skills. He's a terrific dishwasher, and he washes dishes in my house, and he loves to water plants. But you know what? We also found out that he's great at data entry. We put a computer and two screens in front of him, and by the end of one day, he could enter data at 100% accuracy. Wow. He doesn't have the same capacity for making mistakes that I might, just the way his brain works. Well, you tell me, might an employer be interested in a young man who can enter data with 100% accuracy and he never gripes or gossips or complains? I mean, that sounds like a great employee to me. So, you know, you just gotta find the right company that's willing to think outside the box, as I said. And that's what we'll spend the next few years. He'll remain in school until he's 21. And then we'll spend the next this next few years figuring out what's going to be his placement after that. You know, it's sad that a lot of kids on the spectrum, or young adults on the spectrum, finish school at 21 and then they fall off the cliff. That's what we call it in the autism community. They fall off the cliff because educational services stop at that age. And there are not really services that a child is entitled to, a young adult is entitled to after that. So they fall off a cliff. And what they do, a lot of them, is they go back home and they sit on their parents' couch for months or years or sometimes a lifetime. And I know for certain that Ryan does not want to sit on my couch for the rest of his life. He has things he can contribute to the world, and I want him to be able to do so. So we're going to spend, as I said, a few years figuring out what is the right placement or what are the right placements. And then in terms of where will he live, there aren't a whole lot of great options in my home state of South Carolina. There's a very, very decades-long waiting list to get into a residential option. But I've recently accepted an appointment from our governor, our current governor, to serve on our state's Disabilities and Special Needs Commission. And that's one of the things I'm going to be working on, is increasing the supply and the variety of housing to serve the needs across the spectrum.
And can I ask, your youngest son, mm-hmm. what does adulthood look like for him?
Just like Bill Gates. I don't really know. He just starting to hit puberty, and so I'm kind of waiting to see. I'm not even sure what teenagerdom looks like mm-hmm. for him yet. Mm-hmm. We'll be knowing that very soon. But I anticipate that he will go to college, probably MIT, or maybe you told me the
placement. School of Mines.
School of Mines, that great placement right there.
Recruiting.
Okay. We actually our family vacationed here in South Dakota last year and loved it. We had so much fun in the Black Hills area, so he would maybe love to come here. But no, I think he'll go to college, he will live independently, and have some job that I don't understand. That's what I see for his future.
You are a mother, a wife, a lawyer, an author, an educator, a lobbyist, a nonprofit practitioner, a public speaker, expert, law writer. How important have mentors and those around you been in your life?
So I've had some really good mentors in a variety, kind of some more of in a professional capacity and some more personal. Mm-hmm. In a professional capacity, I can single out a particular law professor or maybe two who kind of helped shape my thinking to not think so much and try to learn so much about what the law is, but to think about why it is what it is, and is it right? And I think that, that was 30 years ago, but he really challenged me, Dr. Greg Adams, really challenged me to think about, laws are written by people, and people are imperfect. And if a law is imperfect, like a law that doesn't require coverage for kids with autism, then I'm people, so go change it. I think that mindset helped me when I came upon the inequity that I came upon, where people with autism couldn't get treatment covered. It helped me to realize, well, the law doesn't require this, so let's just go fix the law. Mm-hmm. So I really, I've reconnected with that professor and shared with him how much he shaped my journey. And he's really proud to have been a part of that. I think on the personal side, my mother was a real mentor for me. She was a working mom. She was a corporate vice president with World Book Encyclopedia. Did you guys have World Book in your home? Yes. So she started off as a door-to-door salesperson selling World Book and spent 40 years with that company and became senior vice president. And, that was in the 70s. To have a working mom who was a corporate executive and kind of jet-setting around the country, and she raised five children. I'm the youngest of five. So that was definitely, an important role model for me to believe that I could work and raise kids, but I'll tell you, she gave me good advice that I still live by to this day, which was essentially, if you're going to try to do it all, you got to lower your standards. And you might think, well, that's terrible advice. No, it's great advice. You can't do everything just right. You can't save the world and keep your house clean and send your kids to school dressed just right every day. So you don't want to see my kids or my house, because I've made the decision, we'll be fine. We're not going to live in squalor, but it's not going to be the perfect house to walk into at any time. And, the teachers probably talk about my kids' dirty fingernails some days. It's okay. I chose to work on the more important things to me.
What's the best piece of advice that you've given to somebody?
Well, this is on the personal side again, but every morning when I'm not traveling, when I drop my kids at school, every morning I say to them, smile, because people like people who smile. And I think especially for my youngest son, who struggles with social interactions, that's an important piece of advice, because you can break through a lot of barriers just by opening up a conversation with a smile.
some critical social changes in this country have been led by mothers inspired by something that profoundly impacts their children. For example, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers mm-hmm. has changed the way most people think about drinking and driving, and your work. Can you talk about this?
What's that Margaret Mead quote? The only, help me come up with it.
This is a group effort.
A small, never doubt that a small group of committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And I love that quote because it's just people. And sometimes it's one person. Sometimes it's Aaron Brockovich. Sometimes it's a few mothers from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And you just gotta realize somebody has to initiate every important change that's going to take place in society. And somebody has initiated everyone that has taken place up to this point.
Why do you suppose that's hard for people to do? Why do you suppose so many people, we just march along?
I can speak about that in the autism context, I think, really well, because I remember.
And that wasn't a question specifically about autism.
No, I know it wasn't, but I remember, you know, back in the very early days when I learned that insurance doesn't cover this, and I kept thinking, somebody ought to fix that, you know. Well, what somebody is going to do it? First of all, it's got to be somebody who understands it, so probably somebody living it. Well, those of us living it, we're trying really hard to get through each day, to get a child fed and bathed and into bed, and then we collapse, right? So, I mean, being an autism mom or dad is really difficult and hard and time-consuming and exhausting. So who's got time to go out and change the world on top of that and to, you know, write legislation and advocate? So I just remember really having this, you know, of course nobody's changed it, because the only people who understand it enough and are motivated enough don't have time or resources to go fight the insurance industry.
What other issues would fall in that category? I'm thinking of like homelessness.
Well, true. Right. I mean, somebody's got to fight on behalf of people who are disenfranchised or voiceless. And, you know, in the homeless situation, I think that applies as well. And with a number of disabilities, I mean, I take nothing away from self-advocates in many disability communities. People with the disability can and do speak for themselves. But with some disabilities, they're not capable. My son is not capable. And so it is incumbent upon me to be his voice.
You've worked with lots of families and lots of kids. What are three or four things you think autistic kids want us to know?
Well, I already mentioned that if you've seen one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism. And I think people with autism also find that very important for people to understand that we're all different. We're all different. Depending on the level of functioning of the individual with autism, you know, I think people with autism would maybe want you to know, just because they're not looking at you when they're talking to you doesn't mean they're not engaged with you. Children with autism might find it difficult to make the eye contact, and so they get in trouble at school. And the teacher will say, "You're not listening to me." Well, they are listening. They just don't listen in the same way. They don't make the same kind of eye contact that you and I might make when we're listening. And, you know, there are a lot of practical things, like certain sounds and lighting environments are very offensive, but people with autism can be sensitive to an environment that seems just right for us. So I think it's so important to offer opportunities for people to engage in community without the bright lights or the loud sounds. I saw just this morning on Facebook some arena in Las Vegas, I forgot the name of it, is handing out little backpacks, little drawstring backpacks that have headphones, sunglasses, fidget toys, and something else in them for people with autism. So you can just, because you know, you go to an event, and sometimes I've forgotten to bring Ryan's headphones. And so we might frequently end up leaving halfway through or a quarter way in because Ryan can't take the noise. How great is that to have the arena just have these little packs available? And I just, if more and more businesses become aware of what some of the sensitivities are and can take little steps like that to make the community more friendly for people with autism, that would help immensely.
A couple questions from people in attendance.
Okay.
One is there a book that you recommend that we can learn more about that you recommend for general population to read?
So there are a couple of them that come to mind. One is written by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's called Everything You Need to Know About Autism.
It's a great title.
It's something to that effect. I am profiled in that book. They give a lot of information, but they also profile 20 or 30 different autism figures. And I think that's a really good kind of general informational book. There's also a book that we read when our child was diagnosed called Let Me Hear Your Voice. So it's been out for 20 plus years, but it's a wonderful story about a child with autism who made enormous improvement through ABA. It's just told in a beautiful way, but with a lot of information about the intervention. So that's one that I highly recommend as well. And if you have real insomnia, I recommend my textbook called Autism and the Law. It's 700 pages and it will put you right to sleep.
Another question from somebody in attendance was, what is the percentage of people that receive ABA support?
What is the percentage of people? Wow, I do not know the answer to that question. I mean, it's increasing because, as I said, some years ago, only the wealthy kids were receiving ABA. Now, one thing I have left out altogether is some school systems will employ ABA principles in working with children with autism, but typically it's not delivered in the intensive way that a home or clinic-based program would be, where there's really a one-on-one individualized program. So I kind of skipped over all that, and I should just make that point. But it's increasing dramatically how many people have access to ABA as we pass more and more laws requiring the access to coverage. But I don't think I've got a figure that I can give you on that.
Let's wrap up a couple questions about, you were just here last week.
Mm-hmm.
So last Wednesday, I think you emailed saying, I'm on my way to Sioux Falls, then I'm driving to Pierre to be at the Capitol for committee hearings.
Yes.
Can you give us a synopsis of where South Dakota is?
So some of you know where you are, because I hear you snickering and laughing. Yes, when I agreed to come here to the garage today, I had no idea that I was actually going to be in South Dakota last week as well. So South Dakota is among the 48 states that have passed legislation requiring health insurance coverage for autism treatments, including ABA. You passed that law in 15. Okay, thank you. But when the legislature passed that law in 2015, there were two big gaps in it. Basically, anybody who has an individual health insurance policy, one that you just get for yourself or your family, or anybody who has health insurance through a small employer, a small business, those two types of policies, unless the policy is grandfathered, but those two types of policies were written out of the law. And there was a reason. I mean, you're not the only state that did that. There's a reason that's technical, but it has to do with the state itself was going to have to pay for the benefit rather than it being paid through premiums because of something to do with the Affordable Care Act. Basically, the Affordable Care Act said the state can't add any new benefits to the essential health benefits unless the state is going to pick up the cost. And the South Dakota legislature at that time really wasn't sure what the cost was going to be and just said, well, we're just going to carve out those kinds of policies because we don't want to pick up the cost. So there's legislation pending in the legislature right now to close those gaps. Basically, you know, people who have large group policies or people who are state employees in South Dakota do have ABA coverage, but again, the people with individual policies or small group policies, unless they're grandfathered, don't have the coverage. That's what we're trying to fix. There was a phenomenal hearing last Wednesday. I testified. A slew of parents did a wonderful job testifying. Were any of you there at that hearing? It was amazing.
It was so emotional.
It was, and I've been to a lot of these hearings all across the country. I've worked on this issue in every state. It was as good a hearing as any I have ever been to. I thought the families did a terrific job raising the emotional aspect, but not over the top. You know, just and explaining, look, we're paying premiums for this health insurance policy. We just want it to cover our child's needs. And I've got to tell you, I was astonished at the end when the legislature killed the bill. They voted to defer it to the 41st day, which means kill it. So that's disappointing. There are ongoing efforts. There are potentially some other ways to skin the cat. I met with your governor's office, I met with your division of insurance while I was in Pierre last week, and we're not going to take no as the final answer. We'll continue to work on that because, and it's especially cruel in South Dakota because the insurance companies who offer these small group and individual policies, Avera and Sanford, both were covering ABA for the last couple of years, even though the 2015 law didn't require them to. I'm told that in Sanford's case, it was a mistake that they were covering it, but they didn't realize they didn't have to. So when they learned they didn't have to, they stopped. Avera, I'm told, actually does want to cover it, but what happened is when Sanford stopped covering it, all the autism families flocked to Avera, and that's called adverse selection, and it made the cost go way up for Avera and made it not feasible. So Avera stopped covering it just a few weeks ago. So it's heartbreaking to have all these families who have had that glimpse of hope. They've had their child in ABA therapy, and they've seen the progress, and then boom, it's just pulled away from them overnight. It's heartbreaking. So if you are so inclined to write your legislature, you said there are no pitches here, but I feel like I just got to say, you know, if you're inclined to write your legislator and ask for their support to close that gap, those kids will benefit. And you know, two more little pieces of information on that. The state commissioned a study on the cost. You know, what does it do? I know South Dakota is a very conservative state, as is South Carolina, where I'm from, and they don't want to drive up the cost of premiums for everybody. So they commissioned a study. The addition of autism and ABA coverage impacted premiums by 34 cents per member per month. So the question is, are people willing to pay an extra 34 cents a month so that all these kids can get the treatment they need?
When all 50 states and Indian Health Service cover ABA, then what? What do you do next?
Retire? No, I wish it were, I wish retirement were the answer at the end. It's, you know, even once you get a law on the books and you close up all the gaps that are in the various laws, there's still work to be done, even just on the healthcare front, because you're still dealing with insurance, and there will be delays and denials. Even once the law is on the books, it doesn't work perfectly all the time, as with any other condition, right? This is not specific to autism. There's still work to be done. And my husband, I told you, is a lawyer. He actually has left his law job and started the National Autism Law Center, which is another nonprofit, just to help the families be able to use the laws. So I go around the country passing the laws, and then he comes around behind and helps the families make use of them the way they're supposed to be done. And then even outside of the healthcare context, there are the employment issues, there are the residential issues, so the list is long.
Lori, thank you so much for taking time and making the trip here, getting here yesterday and having conversations, and then all day today. Really appreciate this conversation, and really grateful for your words.